Winter thrills await at Winterfest at Nemacolin. Join the fun on Saturday, February 10th for a day of fun-fueled winter festivities like skiing and snowboarding, snow tubing, ice skating, and snow bikes. You'll be able to meet the Nemacolin Dogs Sled Team, try your hand at ice bowling, compete in the out-cold race, and finish your day with a brew by the fire at the peak. A winter of wonders waiting for you at Nemacolin's Winterfest. Experiences are for overnight guests and members. For more information, visit nemacolin.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Asia Business First podcast. I'm Adam Bakhtir, and today my co-host Julie Yu is away, unfortunately. But fortunately, filling in for her, as always, is Deputy Chief Editor of Digital News, David Bottomley. Welcome again.
It is fortunate that I'm here. I feel thrilled and privileged to be sitting in for Julie this week. And it's always a pleasure to be part of the Asia Business First podcast. Now, it's been a big week here in Singapore for one key reason, and that is the release of the movie Crazy Rich Asians. I don't think it can have escaped anyone's notice that it has been released here. And Adam, I'm assuming that because you mix in the circles,
I knew this was coming,
of the very rich high society types in Singapore, you were first in line with your popcorn in hand to see whether it captured the realities of life in these high society circles.
You know, David, that couldn't be further from the truth, insofar as I didn't catch it because I didn't get a ticket to the red carpet premiere event.
But, it must have been an accident that you were left off the guest
list. I know. I said, where was my invitation? I know a number of people went to it and said it was, you know, a great movie. And I did actually try to catch it this week on Wednesday. It was a public holiday.
Yeah, what happened?
And I tried to get a ticket. It was sold out. Every single cinema, every single timing on Wednesday, even though, and it is a public holiday, but other movies weren't sold out.
Well, surely if you had just mentioned your name, this is Alan Bhatia.
I might have got kicked out,
one of the new rich Asians, that they would have said, yes, we will give you a VIP ticket.
Ooh, I don't know about that on my salary here. But anyway, you know, I did try to get it and I couldn't get a ticket. And I wanted to watch it before this podcast, obviously. But alas, you know, the success of the flick prevented me from doing so, which I suppose is a good thing, right? Because it's so successful, it's earned quite a bit of money in terms of box office numbers.
Indeed. And by all accounts, I haven't seen it either. Okay. But by all
accounts,
I haven't read the book either. Don't expose my lack of insight into what we're going to be talking about for the next 20 minutes. But by all accounts, it is, apart from anything else, a wonderful showcase for Singapore. And the fact that it is a box office success, not just in Singapore, but internationally, it's the US number one box office hit. It bodes well for Singapore, I think.
It does. It's also the first romantic comedy in almost 3 years to open to over $20 million. And at this rate, some have projected an eventual domestic take of more than $100 million. So even without taking into account those overseas numbers that you were just talking about, we can conclude that it's pretty much a big hit.
It is indeed. Now, for anyone who doesn't know what Crazy Rich Asians is about, it is a romantic comedy, as Adam said, about an Asian-American woman who finds out that her boyfriend is from one of the richest families in Singapore. And drama ensues as his mother tries to break them up.
Anyway, today we're going to talk about the real super rich or crazy rich Asians with a man who knows a thing or two about them. He is James Crabtree, Associate Professor in Practice at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. Prior to this, he was the Financial Times Mumbai Bureau Chief and spent 5 years in India, and he's written a book about India's burgeoning billionaire class titled The Billionaire Raj, which I just received today. Thank you very much,
very
James.
Good. Sitting on the desk in front of us.
Sitting on the desk.
Very handsome it does look too.
It does indeed. And you know, I will get to it and read it. But James, let's talk about Crazy Rich Asians. Have you read the book? Have you seen the movie? What did you make of it?
Both. So I read the book when I first moved to Singapore 2 years ago. I reread it the weekend before last, and I saw the movie 8 days ago. I went to see a preview. The movie's pretty good. I mean, I enjoyed it a lot. I can see why people like it so much. In many ways, it's much better than the book. The book is a sort of potboiler, but it's not particularly well written, and so it's interesting for the portrait it gives of the kind of Singaporean high society and all the brand names and these kind of trying to guess who the rich families are that they're talking about, which as an outsider to Singapore I wasn't very well able to do, but I think has been a big part of the fun for people here, is trying to guess who the characters are based on. But as a prose book, it's not very well written, whereas the movie is just terrific fun. I mean, it looks wonderful. As you say, it's a great advert for Singapore. It's very lovingly put together. So, you know, at one point the character goes into a comfort cab. Mm. There's scenes with durians. You see scenes in hawker centres where you have choped tables with kind of credit cards and little kind of tissues on the table. So it all feels very nicely Singaporean. And so I can see why people here like it so much.
Setting aside the fact that it's terrific fun and a piece of Hollywood escapism, to what extent does it actually capture some of the phenomenons which are happening within Asia, that there is the emergence of a new class of hyper-rich people who are increasingly high-profile as well?
Well, so the book is a book, and the movie are sort of satires in a sense. So they've sort of been compared to, and everything from sort of When Harry Met Sally to Jane Austen, right? But it reflects, you know, it wasn't that long ago that Asian countries didn't have these kind of globally comparable super rich, you know, you would have had merchants, but not quite in the same way, not a kind of moneyed aristocracy. So it's bouncing off the fact that countries like Singapore have become incredibly wealthy over the last 30 or 40 years. Now, does it accurately reflect the way in which the super rich behave? I mean, I guess to some extent it does, that there are, you know, you look at the streets here, have got lots of Bugattis and Ferraris, and people like their brand names. There's, you know, Singapore has no shortage of shops where you can buy this stuff. So certainly there is something accurate about the way in which the super rich behave. I suspect it's kind of exaggerated for comic effect, as you'd expect in a movie like this, but it's sort of tapping into something serious that's going on here as people try and grasp with Singapore, a country that used to be, you know, poorish and is now very, very rich.
Mm. And it's not just a Singapore phenomenon. I mean, you've drilled into some of these things more specifically in the Indian context. What is happening there?
Let me get to India in just a second. The broader context here. So, I mean, the argument I've made about the film, the serious argument, I think, is that the film is really a kind of celebration. It's fun. I think people will go and see it. They'll enjoy it. It's escapism. But it does tell you something a bit more serious, which is that Asia in general, and particularly this part of Asia, so I'll come to India in a minute, but this part of Asia was famous for growing quickly and successfully, moving from poverty to what they call middle-income status to being rich, but to doing so in a way that was relatively equitable without lots of inequality. Now that's changing. So Singapore is pretty much the most unequal country in Asia, but all across Asia you see countries growing more unequal. And this is true in the West, obviously, as well, but the gap between rich and poor is growing. And so I suppose I have argued that you can read Crazy Rich Asians as a celebration, but it's also a warning of a way that kind of Asia is going. Asia is becoming less egalitarian, and there are reasons to worry about that. India is a sort of rather different case. I mean, we can talk about it in more depth if you want, but India is a much poorer country, much earlier in its development. But it also has crazy rich Indians. You know, it has a new billionaire class that is now, they have more billionaires in India than any other country apart from China and the US. Some people call them, in Russia, the super rich are called oligarchs. In India, they're sometimes called boligarchs, you know, very, very wealthy people who have a kind of sense of bling about them. And so this phenomenon you see in crazy rich Asians here in Singapore, you see in India as well.
Right. And, you know, having lived in both India and now in Singapore, is there a difference between how the wealthy conduct themselves there and how they're perceived? Or is this wealth agnostic in the eyes that sort of don't have it?
I mean, I think there is now a cosmocratic, wealthy elite that has more in common with each other than they do with people in their own country. So if you're super rich in Singapore, you probably have super rich Singaporean friends. One of the things that's interesting about Crazy Rich Asians from almost like a sociological point of view is the insight it gives not into Indian wealth, because there are no Indian characters and no Malay characters, which is one of the minor controversies around the film, but the insight it gives into Chinese wealth, by which I mean that it does give a portrayal of a specifically Chinese kind of money. So the Chinese sort of financial corporate elite that is prosperous in Malaysia, that is prosperous in Indonesia, that's clearly prosperous in China and Hong Kong and here. And so there's a sort of sense of the interconnectedness of that ethnically Chinese elite in the movie that you see. It pops up a few times. I thought it was interesting. India is a special case, right? I mean, Singapore's a much, much, much richer country than India is. And so the Indian elite is unusual because they're comparably wealthy to the Singaporeans, but they exist in a much poorer country. And so the circumstances that they find themselves are just different.
You mentioned just now that the film kind of plays into a narrative about growing inequalities both in Singapore and around Asia. And you mentioned very specifically that there are good reasons to worry about this. Why is this something to worry about?
Well, so one way of looking at sort of rich people and the fact that there are rich people is that this is like a good thing, you know, a sign of a society that's doing well. Some people, everyone does well and the rich do better than others. You know, what's no reason to particularly worry about that? We don't want to be too envious. A lot of these people are, you know, making money by running great companies, being successful. Mm. One shouldn't be envious of that. One should celebrate it. And I think, you know, I used to work for the Financial Times, which is a business newspaper. I'm not a kind of hammer of the rich in all of this. I think that, you know, if you look at people like Alibaba's Jack Ma or someone like Anthony Tan, the founder of Grab, you know, these are very admirable people. They make their money broadly the right way. But so some of the money that is portrayed in Crazy Rich Asians is a different kind of money. It's sort of ancestral, handed down. People didn't earn their money. Almost none of the characters in the movie earned their own money. They all inherited it. And so there's a sort of problem with kind of aristocratic inherited wealth, which becomes entrenched. So that's one thing. This the Crazy Rich Asians doesn't deal with corruption, but there's a problem with money that is made not by running great businesses, but by getting favors from the government. And so that has been a problem in many parts of Asia. It's particularly true in India. But there's a whole range of reasons to be worried about really yawning inequality. So some inequality is okay. But really, really big levels of inequality, very, very unequal countries, people in them are unhappier. They are less financially stable. Their political system is unstable. And the real risk for Asia is look at the politics of the West, look at Trump, look at Brexit. In some sense, this is a reaction to countries that have grown less equal, where the kind of broad working people and the middle class have done less well than the elite. And eventually, politics responds to that, and you get kind of populism and nastiness. And you haven't had so much of that in Asia yet, but you could do. If Asia grows more and more unequal, as has happened in the West, then there will be a political reaction. People will eventually get peeved by the fact that some people are doing far, far better than others. And so the egalitarian tradition in Asia, which is true in Singapore, you know, true in many parts of the region, the fact that people were looked after is something to kind of keep hold of. It's one of the things that's been very admirable about the Asian growth model. And it's particularly still true in countries like Japan and Korea, which are really quite egalitarian compared to the West. And so in this sense, the countries that I'm from are a kind of warning to Asia, which is don't become sort of as unequal as America. Try and kind of guard what has been good about your development story.
So in a way, you're saying that people, whether they're writing the books or you know, scripting movies and actually producing, need to tread carefully insofar as, you know, you better be careful what you wish for. Because, I mean, if you can come up with something really successful, is it the type of spotlight and publicity that you really want?
No, I mean, I think the books and the movies are fine, right? I mean, the book is more ostensibly a satire. So I think the book has a bit more kind of edge to it than the movie. The movie is a bit more sort of escapist and fun. But it's interesting, as I say, so you talked about the plot of the movie. So it's about this Asian-American, she's an economics professor, so she's a sort of meritocrat. And to an extent, her boyfriend, the rich guy, has a PhD. He's also a young academic. But almost all of their friends, as I say, they inherited their money. The only character who, in a sense, is sort of economically worthy is the husband of one of the other characters. And he's a software entrepreneur, like a struggling guy trying to set up like a dot-com business. And he's portrayed as a sort of loser, like he's not doing very well. And so the way the movie portrays wealth, it sort of celebrates people who inherited all their money and did absolutely nothing to earn it. And it portrays the one guy who's sort of struggling to kind of create something of value. And now that sort of instinct is a little alarming, right? If you, in a sense, you should be celebrating your wealth creators and you should be slightly critical, as I think the book was, of the sort of feckless people who are just inheriting their money and spending it on Ferraris. Like, those people add nothing to society. The wealth creators are the ones who are worth celebrating.
But do you think people are going to be looking at the movie, sitting in the cinema and seeing the portrayals of this entrenched wealth, with a sense of frustration and envy, and perhaps when they're walking the streets of Singapore and seeing people driving around in their Bugattis thinking, well, this is an absolute outrage. Surely they're going to be thinking, well, this is just the way of the world. There are some people who are very rich. I may not be one of them. I might like to be one of them. But the fact that these rich people do exist is an inevitable part of societal development.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think people are necessarily, as I say, I think people will enjoy the movie for what it is, which is, as I enjoyed it. It's good fun. It's sort of, it's a bit of escapism. It's frothy. It's very funny. It's particularly, as I say, it's great fun if you live in Singapore, because it's a sort of very loving recreation of the city that we all live in, either if we're, you know, people who are from here or visitors in someone else's home. You know, but still, I think you can look at these things. You know, it's not often you see a big movie about Singapore. In fact, this is basically the first one ever. So it's reasonable to look at it in a kind of skeptical way and say, okay, so they made this thing. What does it tell us about the place? So I happen to look at it. I'm at the Lee Kuan Yew School. I'm an analyst of economic development. Other people have looked at the movie and looked at its racial politics, the fact that it only features Chinese people, for instance, and so it has been criticized in some circles for the fact that it's not a very good reflection of the breadth of Singaporean society, because there are other Singaporeans who don't really feature. Now, you can say that's fair enough. You can say that's, you know, maybe that's a bit over the top because it's only a romantic comedy that we're talking about. But I think this is clearly a phenomenon, right? You know, there have been many movies about Singapore before, but none of this sort in Hollywood. It is the first Hollywood movie in a generation that features an all-Asian cast. It's been seen to be a huge deal in the United States amongst Asian Americans, who view this as a huge breakthrough for a traditionally underrepresented audience. So both from a Singaporean perspective, but from a kind of Asian diaspora perspective, this film is significant. And so I think it's kind of reasonable to sort of, you know, admit that people are going to enjoy it and, you know, go and see it for what it is, but also, you know, poke at it a little bit and say, you know, what does this tell us about some broader themes?
Right. So you're obviously not surprised about the level of interest that is generated, at least here in Singapore, obviously with tickets sold out at every cinema. But what do you think will draw the audiences from abroad? I mean, what will be of interest to them?
I thought it was going to do really well here. I mean, insofar as I have an insight into what people were like in Singapore, I was pretty convinced that people would love it, because it's just a rarity to see your own city portrayed like this and your own society, like people are interested in that. I guess I could have been persuaded that it might have flopped in the US, just, but, you know, for whatever reason. Why do I think it has been a success? I think it's a good film, like on its own merits. It's funny, it's fast-paced, it has really good characters, it's an ensemble cast. The two main characters are actually the least interesting characters in there. The male lead, whatever his name is, Henry Young, he's quite charming. But actually there are other characters, the sort of incidental, her friend, who's played by a kind of comic actress. She's great. I mean, there's some really strong characters in there. But I think people are fascinated by the super rich, right? I mean, the kind of the bling element of this, whether it's simply voyeurism or it's a more kind of aspirational sort of insight, people are curious. It's the same phenomenon as to why people watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians or that kind of thing. Like, people are generally curious about the lives of people who live this existence that is so far away from the one that ordinary people are able to have access to. And on the one hand, there's something kind of positive about that. But there's also a kind of little warning there, right? That when the super rich lead these lives of kind of privileged seclusion of private jets and first class travel and never having to go on public transport because they're in a totally different ambit, there's also a little warning there that you don't want your super rich to be entirely set apart from the rest of society. And so, again, you've got to watch this sort of cautiously and think, you know, are we celebrating the creation of a new moneyed aristocracy in a country like Singapore? Or are we thinking that actually that might not be a very good thing for the country as a whole?
So what's the solution? I mean, the existence of the super rich in basically all countries is a truism. And if we do want the super rich to not be completely isolated and not be just jetting around on private jets, what can be done to ensure that these divisions do not become so entrenched that people do see the super rich as isolated and irrelevant and not part of the overall society?
Well, the super rich are not a kind of natural phenomenon. It's like, you know, people would say the poor have always been with us. But actually, you know, the rise of the 1%, the 0.001% is a phenomenon of the last sort of 20 years in the West and to some degree in some Asian countries as well. It's a response to practical things like the changing way that we tax people or the structure of the economy or the way in which particular industries have been allowed to prosper. And so if you were to look 30 years ago, then there weren't quite as many super rich people as there are now. There's always going to be people who are richer than others. There's really no getting away from that. But you can find ways to make sure that the super rich pay their taxes. Those at the bottom are kind of lifted up and helped. And so if you look at as I say, some Asian countries like Japan and Korea and some European countries like in Scandinavia just do this better than others because they have governments that think that it's a good thing not to have enormously large gaps between the rich and the poor. You know, some is fine, and you don't want to kind of tax the rich out of existence to the point where they don't start businesses anymore and that sort of thing. But there are some countries that decide that having lower levels of inequality are more important than others, and I think there's some benefit to that.
Oh, speaking of which, I mean, in India, I just want to get to sort of what motivated you to write your book, The Billionaire Raj. I mean, I haven't read it yet, but how close does it cut to reality in India? I've never been there, but perhaps bringing in David's speculation that I only mix with the ultra-rich well-heeled here. I do know some, you know, very comfortably well-off Indians who reside in Singapore, and I mix with them socially, and just by seeing that anecdotally, I mean... It looks like it could be quite over the top in India.
I mean, India is a very colourful society anyway. So when you have the creation of this new super rich, then you layer on top often a kind of culture that is kind of technicolor and, you know, the culture of Bollywood and Indian weddings. We know about this. And so the Indian super rich have a kind of character all of their own. I mean, the story of India is in a sense an even more recent one than Singapore. So Singapore has been growing wealthy for, you know, 40 years and is now richer than almost all of the countries of the West. India is nowhere near that. I mean, it has a GDP per capita of $1,700 a year. The average person, that's what they earn. So it's still really poor, you know, more like Myanmar than Singapore. But nonetheless, over the last 15 years, there's been an explosion of wealth at the very top of India. In the mid-1990s, there were 2 billionaires. There's now something like 120. Collectively, these people earn $450 billion or own $450 billion. And as I say, that's more than any other country apart from the US and China. So India has... although it's still quite a poor country, it's created wealth at the very, 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 very top, almost as quickly as any country in history. And these people are not the people that you're circulating with here in Singapore. No. Like, these are the spectacularly wealthy that I'm interested in.
See, David?
Well, it might, you know, maybe you are, but you know, the richest man in India is also the richest man in Asia. His name is Mukesh Ambani. His house appears on the front cover of...
Is that the 25-story building?
That's right. It's actually a 70-story building, but 70. It has 27 triple height stories in it. It's called the Billion Dollar House. It's what people call it in Mumbai. And so his house alone, this skyscraper for him and his wife and his three kids, is this kind of icon in Mumbai, where I used to live, of the new Indian super elite. And in a sense, the thing that's special about the Indian super elite is that they live in India, which is a country where most people have very, very little. Mm. And so even in Singapore, the gap between the very, very rich and you know, the sort of ordinary people is quite large. But in India, it's massive. It's as big as anywhere in the world. So.
And to what extent is that an issue in India, that the emergence of this super elite, super rich people who have benefited perhaps disproportionately from India's economic growth, it's been seen as a bad thing which needs to be addressed?
Well, I think you see both sides of this, right? I mean, India for a long time, so you and I are both British, in a sense, so a lot of this is our fault. The Brits were there until 1947, then we left, and India decided that it would set up a kind of closed socialist economy for 40 years, and that didn't go very well. And so it was only in the early 1990s that they sort of reopened again. And so the phenomenon of the super rich is a sort of post-liberalization phenomenon, that's what you'd call it, really only actually in the last 10 or 15 years. And so people who grew up in the socialist era actually often they celebrate the super rich because they're successful. It shows that India is a kind of normal country again, where you have really rich people who can buy Ferraris, and this is a sort of mark of success. Nonetheless, there are reasons, again, to be worried about this. Some people who've grown rich in India have done so because they have been corrupt, more or less. They've sort of worked political contacts. And as I say, the lesson of East Asia, of Singapore, Taiwan, Japan, Korea, the successful economies in this part of the world, is they developed in a particular way that has been much more successful than anyone else. And they were, broadly speaking, quite egalitarian places. So recently, somewhere like Singapore has grown more unequal. But when Lee Kuan Yew was alive, and in the kind of the 70s and the 80s, Singapore was quite a kind of equal society. And the problem for India is it's grown very, very unequal very early. And most of the countries that have developed successfully haven't been as unequal as India is now. And so there's reasons to think that if India stays as unequal as it is or gets even worse, that it will find it more difficult to move beyond being a poor country and kind of clamber up that development ladder.
And is there a degree of dissatisfaction and anger amongst the massed ranks of the middle and lower classes of what has happened to the point where it's an issue that politicians need to deal with or risk losing power?
So as with everything in India, it's a bit complicated. Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, won a big election in 2014, and he did so on a pro-growth, pro-jobs, anti-corruption platform, which was to some degree a reaction against the perception that the rich were just sort of making out like bandits, you know, sort of had the politicians in their pockets. And so there was a political reaction to what happened in the middle of the 2000s, which lots of corruption scandals and a sense that these tycoons were just totally out of control. But my perception is that what you might think would happen in India is you have all these people who are quite poor, many live in slums. I used to live in Mumbai. Half the population of Mumbai, a city of 25 million people. So Mumbai alone is five times as big as Singapore by population, and half of those people live in slums still in this tiny sort of packed-in city. You would think that the people in the slums would be really angry at the rich, but they're not really. Actually, if you speak to people who don't have very much money, they tend to be the people who are quite admiring of these people. They see them as being successful. The people who don't like them are the middle classes. The middle classes sort of think that they're corrupt and that they are making their money in ways that are unfair and that the system is kind of bent in their favor. So actually, it's the other way around, that the people who come out on the streets and protest about corruption tend to be the kind of the urban middle classes. And the people either in the villages or in the urban slums are sort of less perplexed about this. It's sort of an interesting difference. So.
Yeah, I mean, looking at Singapore, when you talk about the divide of the rich and the poor, it's a unique place, though. I mean, when you compare it to countries like India, there's no shortage of support in Singapore from the government. When you look at, for instance, their housing policies and all the various programs to help entrepreneurs in this country, is it the case that, say, in places like Singapore, that when we talk about the divide between the rich and poor, or that it's really just the rich that have gone leaps and bounds, largely because, you know, whether it perhaps capital markets have performed so well over the past few decades that they have just decoupled from the rest of society, whereas it doesn't necessarily mean that the poor have become poorer, it's just that they just became a whole lot richer.
No, but that, I mean, you're right. So there's a difference here between relative and absolute prosperity. So in Singapore, everyone is, roughly speaking, everyone is doing better than they were, than their parents did. And that's definitely true in India. And this is the problem in the West, that actually that's no longer true. The real resentment that resulted in Trump's election and in Brexit is the fact that actually people of my generation or younger are not doing as well as their parents did. And so that's the real problem when you get this sense that you're literally falling behind. Nonetheless, even if, so let's take India rather than Singapore as the example. India has got a very good record of poverty reduction. It's lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. So most people are doing better than they were 10 years ago. Still, you know, we're human beings. Like, we don't judge ourselves against some imaginary benchmark. We think about how are we doing relative to others. And so if we're doing reasonably better, but that guy over there is doing much, much, much better, then you might think, well, why is he doing much better than me? Does he deserve what he gets? And in particular, if that guy is doing much better than me and you think that guy's corrupt or he's fiddling the system or there's injustice, then people become, I don't want to, resentful is perhaps the wrong word to say, but people think, well, maybe the rules are rigged. Maybe this system isn't actually acting in my interest. And, you know, relatively recently in Singapore's history, in the aftermath of the 2011 election, there was a sort of period of national reflection in which many people thought that the priorities of the country were not in the right direction, that maybe it was spending too much time thinking about, you know, the kind of global elite and the rich and sort of setting up this cosmopolitan city, but it wasn't spending enough time investing in trains and buses and new houses and the sort of things that ordinary Singaporeans wanted. And I think that was a kind of reasonable reflection to go through. That in the recent history of Singapore within the last 10 years, you had a moment in which actually people came together and thought, maybe we don't quite have our priorities right here. Maybe we're thinking a bit too much about the interests of the top dogs, and we should be thinking a bit more about everybody else. And I think that it's quite healthy, really, to go through those moments of reflection. And in a sense, that's what the problem there is: relative inequality. It's the fact that some people are doing really, 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 really well, and particularly if we think they might not deserve all of that stuff that they're getting, then that's a problem. That's when people begin to start questioning whether the rules of the game are not fair.
Good to bring it back to Singapore for some concluding thoughts there.
Yes.
I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, James Crabtree, Associate Professor in Practice at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy and author of The Billionaire Raj. And Adam, where are you going to be jetting off to in your private jet this weekend?
Oh, I wish I had a private jet. That's an acronym that they've come up with, PJs, and I use it for pajamas, but the ultra wealthy are using it for private
jets. But you wear your PJs
jets.
On your PJs. Yeah. I understand.
Mo, who knows, one day if I win the lottery, right? All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And remember to catch Asia Business First every Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. sharp, Singapore, Hong Kong time, with Julie Yu and myself. Until the next podcast, we'll see you on TV.
If you've been hurt by a truck, you can call Colombo Law 24/7, and we'll be there to make sure you're taken care of. When someone is hurt by a truck, Colombo Law is the law firm people call to get answers. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.